Daily news and analysis. We keep you informed and inspired.
This is World Today.
The European Parliament has approved the Artificial Intelligence Act with an overwhelming majority. US government has announced it will send $300 million of military aid to Ukraine. Five American labor unions have filed a petition with the Office of U.S. Trade Representative requesting a probe into China's shipbuilding industry. Welcome to World Today, a news program with a different perspective. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. To listen to this episode again or to catch up on previous episodes, you can download our podcast by searching World Today. The European Parliament has approved the Artificial Intelligence Act with an overwhelming majority in France. The legislation bans certain AI uses, introduces new transparency rules, and requires risk assessments for AI systems that are deemed high risk. It is the first ever comprehensive legal framework on AI globally. The act, which needs final endorsement, will most likely enter into force this May. For more on the act, I earlier had a conversation with Andy Mok, tech analyst and senior research fellow at the Center for China and Globalization. In general, how do you see the significance of this act, the first of its kind in the world?
Well, I think from a symbolic perspective, as we all know, this is the first regarding artificial intelligence. But I think as to its actual practical significance, we have to wait and see for two reasons. I think, first of all, that being first is not always the best, meaning if you're the first to do something very new, you may make some mistakes because no one's ever done it before. So I think that's one thing to keep in mind. The second is that while I think there is broad agreement that countries need to work together to address the challenges of AI, there are also powerful countervailing forces that are incentivizing countries to pursue their own path. So I think we have to wait and see exactly how significant this piece of legislation from the EU will be.
In your observation, why was the European Union able to become the first governmental organization to pass this law?
Well, you know, I think there are three major global players when it comes to AI regulation. There's the EU, of course. There's the United States, and there's China. And I think one thing that separates the U.S. and China from the EU is that both China and the EU AI superpowers in that they not only have a large market for the use of AI for both consumers and businesses, but they are also leaders in the technology and the business of AI, whereas Europe is perhaps not in the same category. And I think what this has done, the EU, to look for ways to maintain relevance, and one way perhaps is by being first to announce or to pass and announce a major piece of legislation.
Well, I'm sure you have looked at the specific terms or clauses. I mean, which one strikes you the most?
Well, I think the philosophy and the structure of it makes sense in that the way it views regulating AI is through risk categorization. So one category, things that are completely unacceptable, some that are high, some are medium, some that are low risk. So I think this is a very sensible approach because you certainly don't want to over-regulate where you might stifle innovation or make it not feasible to offer products and services based on AI that many consumers and businesses would benefit from. So I think this is a very sensible approach. But again, we have to see it's all in the implementation. And I think what matters as much is what the developers of the technology and the businesses that actually implement these technologies will do in response. So while the EU is a very important market, I think that big companies also have choices as well into how much effort they may put into a particular market. So I think this is one of the things to keep an eye on as we go forward.
Mm. Andy, how do you see the global impact of this act?
Well, you know, I think we have to wait and see again. I think from a symbolic perspective, it's certainly noteworthy in that being first does capture some attention. But the important, I think, piece that we have to also consider is the underlying technology and how it is commercialized and brought to market. And here, I think both China and the U.S. bring a bit more to the table, and I think that this is something to keep an eye on in addition to the regulations and the laws that are passed.
As you already kind of mentioned, EU is a big market for AI products, and lots of companies, you know, from outside the European Union might want their product to enter the European market. In that case, they have to follow this act. I mean, will that force governments of these companies to follow the EU Act as well?
Well, I think we have to see, because if it's the U.S. and China, my guess is perhaps not, because these are sizable markets in and of themselves, and they also exert not an inconsiderable amount of diplomatic influence as well. So, you know, I think whether they will follow, I think, is a question mark. But I think it's perhaps more likely that they will want to lead and not follow. And this goes back to my earlier point that these major groups, China, the U.S., and the EU, see the importance of working together. But at the same time, they also have powerful incentives to want to develop their own systems of regulation, standards around technology, et cetera. And this is a force for fragmentation. So again, I think this is what makes this a very interesting space to watch as these two opposing forces play out.
Andy, in general, this legislation is backed by fines of up to 7% of a company's worldwide revenue. How do you comment on that?
Well, I think this goes to the point of companies have choices. So we see, on the one hand, Apple chose to go along with review required. So certainly that's one possibility that can happen. But if these requirements and the potential fines are too onerous, then companies may just decide it's not worth the risk or the cost. And of course, if that were to happen, European consumers would suffer, and European businesses may actually fall far behind, because if AI is truly as important for businesses, for industrial applications, and not just for consumer applications, it's going to become a necessary input to maintain global competitiveness.
The United Kingdom tried to host the first global AI regulation summit last year. Andy, how do you see the progress of AI international regulation at the moment?
Well, I think it was certainly seen in most circles as very welcome to have this kind of dialogue that included many, if not most, countries in the world, as well as a variety of other stakeholders, corporations, NGOs, et cetera. But at the same time, I think there's some cause for concern in that there was also some efforts to, not efforts, but actual exclusion of China from part of the discussion. And it seems to me that, again, given the size of the Chinese market, but more importantly, the Chinese advances in technology, and, you know, a lot of attention is given to generative AI, ChatGPT, but we shouldn't forget that China actually leads in some of the most important areas of AI, image recognition. TikTok, which has been in the news quite a lot lately, actually is widely considered to be the first company to successfully place AI at the center of its business, because it was able to offer very effective user recommendations that did not rely on other input. So, for example, Facebook relied on what the friends of users were looking at as an input, whereas TikTok was Douyin, ByteDance, and TikTok, of course, were much more efficient and, again, widely considered as the first really successful instance of artificial intelligence. So to exclude China because it's a technology leader, seems quite short-sighted and self-defeating.
Well, finally, on China, Andy, Chinese President Xi Jinping has proposed the Global AI Governance Initiative for fair and safe use of AI. The Chinese government has issued interim measures for managing generative AI, which applies to text, picture, audio, video, and other content generated for people inside China. What impact do you think China's AI policies will have on both domestic market and international joint efforts to regulate AI?
Well, I think China will have a profound impact on AI regulation for the reasons, first, for the reasons I mentioned earlier, so market size, technology leadership.
Mm.
But the other thing we have to consider is the unique nature of China's political system in that it is the only major country in the world able to not only formulate policy directives, including laws and regulations, but it can implement them in a holistic and systematic way from the national level to the provincial level to the municipal level, even down to the neighborhood level. And because of this, I think it is much more likely that China will arrive at a workable, sustainable regulatory regime for artificial intelligence that actually works and incorporates the diverse interests of society, business, consumers, other parts of society in a balanced way. Whereas if we look at, for example, the U.S. in comparison, while it's certainly possible for the U.S. and the White House or even Congress to announce certain initiatives, the ability to actually implement them and sustain them is much more questionable. So legislation is like anything else. People want what works, and this is a brand new area. There's a lot to learn. Mistakes will be made. But the most important thing is the feedback loop. How quickly can you learn from, how quickly can mistakes be identified?
Mm.
How quickly can you learn from them? And perhaps most importantly, how do you minimize the cost of these mistakes? And I think in this regard, China's best positioned to do that.
That was Andy Ma, a tech analyst and senior research fellow at the Center for China and Globalization. Coming up, U.S. and the European Union are sending more military aid to Ukraine. This is World Today. Stay with us.
Hello, my name is Alessandro Golombievski Teixeira. I'm a professor of public policy and management at Tsinghua University in Beijing. I am a great listener of The World Today. In my opinion, The World Today is one of the best China radio programs. In The World Today, we can get the best news and analysis in what is happening now in the world. So please, come to join us.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. The Biden administration has announced it will send $300 million of military aid to Ukraine. This comes as a $60 billion funding bill remains stuck in U.S. Congress. European Union countries have also agreed to provide 5 billion euros for military aid to Ukraine as part of a revamp of an EU-run assistance fund. Russian President Vladimir Putin has warned the U.S. not to send troops to assist Ukraine. He also says his country is technically ready for a nuclear war. This comes following an attack on Russian soil by pro-Ukrainian militias and a series of drone attacks on Russian oil facilities. Megumi Lim has more.
Rockets, ammunition, and anti-aircraft rounds are among the $300 million worth of military aid being sent to Ukraine by the United States. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said the package was funded by unanticipated cost savings from Pentagon contracts, but warned that although the latest assistance will help address some of Ukraine's pressing needs, it does not replace the $60 billion funding bill that remains stuck in Congress.
This ammunition will keep Ukraine's guns firing for a period, but only a short period. It is nowhere near enough to meet Ukraine's battlefield needs, and it will not prevent Ukraine from running out of ammunition in the weeks to come. This package does not displace and should not delay the critical need to pass the bipartisan national security bill.
On Wednesday, in an interview with Russian news agency RIA, Vladimir Putin said he believed the cross-border incursions into Russia carried out by Ukraine-based paramilitary groups on Tuesday were meant to disrupt the presidential elections starting on Friday. The Freedom of Russia Legion, the Russian Volunteer Corps, and the Siberian Battalion, reportedly made up of Russian citizens fighting on the Ukrainian side, have claimed their cross-border operations are still ongoing. Videos posted on their Telegram channels allegedly showed fighting taking place on Russian territory. Meanwhile, in Ukraine, Russian drone and bomb attacks killed at least three people overnight, according to local officials. In Sumy, a Russian drone hit an apartment block, wounding at least eight people and killing two. And a Russian bomb was dropped in Mirnograd in the Donetsk region, killing two and injuring five people. Over in Russia, the defense ministry claimed 65 Ukrainian drones were shot down overnight and in the early hours of Wednesday, allegedly targeting more oil refineries for the second day in a row. The Novoshakhtinsk oil refinery in the Rostov region was shut down after a drone attack, according to the regional governor.
Magem Lim with the report. For more, we're joined by Pavel Fagenhauer. He's a Russian military analyst based in Moscow. Thank you, Pavel. It's good to have you back on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Pavel, EU countries have agreed to provide 5 billion euros of military aid for Ukraine. How significant is this at the moment?
Well, this is a very important kind of organizational change. I mean, the European countries were supplying Ukraine. That's why Ukraine is still fighting, surely against much stronger and better equipped Russia. So this is an organizational kind of thing that's going to streamline what Europe has been sending, and maybe also there'll be more coming in the pipeline. There was a lot of wrangling inside Europe on how this is going to work, because European countries, many of them, are sending individual packages of aid, and they wanted this aid to be included in their contribution to the 5 billion fund. But there is going to be a compromise. Part of it will be included as part of this fund, but not all of it. So this fund will be also kind of separate, and it will be multinational, and it will not require for distribution of funds on the agreement within all the members of the European Union, which is always a bit of a problem, because a number of European nations, like Hungary and now Slovakia, are very skeptical about supporting Ukraine. And so for finding a consensus each time it's cumbersome. This fund is going to distribute money. It will not be hampered by individual nations putting up a veto.
Well, you already talked about the different opinions of member states within the European Union, especially countries like Hungary. I mean, overall, Pavel, where does the European Union stand regarding its position on the war in Ukraine? You know, it's already been more than 2 years.
Quite a number of European countries are supporting Ukraine. Of course, there's always differences on how to do that. Some nations are more kind of anti-Russian, others are less. But there's the understanding and need that they should do something more. Right now, there's this Czech halter shell initiative right now being realized. Apparently, that will provide Ukraine with hundreds of thousands of halter shells in the coming weeks. Europe, they say that they cannot replace fully what America is supplying, but they are also trying to do their best. And some European nations, say like France, which is right now very kind of changed its position to being much more anti-Russian, well, maybe sees the situation in traditional French foreign policy terms. They always France since the time of General Charles de Gaulle, wanted to separate somehow Russia, Europe from America. Mm-hmm. And so America having less interest in Ukraine, at least the Republican Party, the theme there is giving the Europeans a possibility to become more strategically independent.
Mm. Pavel, the U.S. Announced a new $300 million weapon package for Ukraine, but a further $60 billion funding remains stalled by Republicans in U.S. Congress. What does this mean for Ukraine? And Pavel, will that $60 billion funding ever come?
Well, there's a lot of wrangling inside Washington about what to do further with Ukraine and how much to support it. In Moscow, the view is that in the end, Washington is going to work out something, and that this aid, if not all of it, but a large part of it, is going to reach Ukraine. It's not that America is actually stopping supporting and supplying Ukraine. Though in Russia, the opinion basically is that if the West wants this terrible war to end, and the crisis that is happening right now because of that in Europe, they should stop supplying Ukraine with weapons and massive financial aid, and the war is going to end through negotiation.
Mm.
But that is not seen as an immediate scenario. The Americans will most likely do what they believe is right in the end.
Well, Pavel, in general, how do you see the situation on the fighting ground now, Pavel?
Well, it's basically still a stalemate. Of course, right now it's already spring, and the sun is very bright today in Moscow, which means that there's going to be a lot of, as the snow melts, there's going to be a lot of dirt, so that offensive, effective attacks become not very possible.
Mm.
So the stalemate will continue for some time, some weeks at least, but the summer fighting season is coming up, and I believe both sides in the front line, from the Russians and from the Ukrainian side, they are preparing for the coming summer fighting season, begins somewhere in the end of April and lasts till October, to achieve something substantial, to change the equilibrium on the battlefield, to end the stalemate.
Well, how long do we have to wait before we have the slightest hope of negotiations?
Well, again, that depends on what's going to happen on the battlefield, what happens politically in Ukraine, in the West. Will the Ukrainian military continue to fight against very serious odds, or their morale is going to snap? We'll know that most likely in the coming months. Without the drastic changes on the battlefield, I don't believe that substantial negotiations can bring a resolution to this conflict before something really serious happens on the battlefield, the change of a situation.
Mm. Briefly, and Pavel, how is Russia, coping with the situation now?
Well, war is war. There's casualties. There's a lot of expenses. Russia is spending a lot and spending even more all the time to produce weapons and for the war effort and run the economy under sanctions. But basically, I would say that Russia right now is coping with the situation. But there are different problems. Of course, Ukraine also has lots of problems,
Thank
maybe
you.
Even more.
Indeed.
But for the time...
I have to stop you there. Sorry, Pavel. That was Pavel Fagenhauer. He's Russia military analyst based in Moscow. This is World Today. We're going to a short break. When we come back, we'll take a look at a petition filed against China's shipbuilding industry by U.S. labor unions. This is World Today. Stay with us.
I am Dan Wang. chief economist of Hang Seng Bank China. The World Today is a real fun program. You will hear interesting people discussing global trend, economic event, what's happening in and outside of China. So, friends around the world, hope you can join us.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. Five U.S. labor unions have filed a petition with the Office of U.S. Trade Representative Catherine Tai requesting a probe into China's shipbuilding industry. The petition on Tuesday accuses China of unfair policies and practices in the maritime logistics and shipbuilding sectors. The petition was filed under Section 301 of the Trade Act of 1974, a statute the U.S. claims to be aiming at combating trade partners' unfair practices. The USTR office said it will review the allegations from the unions and decide within 45 days whether they are worth a response. Now, for more on this, we're joined by Professor Qu Qiang, Fellow of Belt and Road Research Center at Minzu University of China. Thank you, Professor Qu, for joining us again.
Thank you.
Now, first, Professor, help us understand the general competitiveness of China's shipbuilding industry now. How strong is it?
Well, I think the shipbuilding industry right now in China is very strong for sure. We can just judge it by two dimensions. One is the quantity, and second is about technology. Mm-hmm. By quantity, I think China right now is making more than 70% of the civilian use, that commercial ships. And also by the technology, China is probably the only country right now can actually build and design the top-notch technology ships. For example, the LNG ship. Mm-hmm. And also the aircraft carrier for the military purpose. And also we can build, the cruise ship for the tourism purposes. And also more than that, we can build offshore the wind farm as well as for the tension-like oil drilling platform on the ocean. So all this actually are right now the current crown jewel of modern industry. So that is the position of the current Chinese shipbuilding industry.
Mm. Professor Qu, how important is shipbuilding industry for a country's overall industrial system and structure? Why does it matter so much?
Well, shipbuilding industry itself is a very important industry because it concerns upstream and downstream. It's a very large and complicated ecosystem. For example, when America are prime in this industry back in the 1970s, the whole industry will probably feed it more than 200,000 of the workers directly in the whole system. Mm-hmm. And also the whole ecology are probably creating more than 2 million of jobs inside of America. And that's when we're talking about in the 1970s. Mm. It was a huge industry itself. And furthermore than that, the shipbuilding capacity also reflected the country's capacity in the global trade. Because with your own capacity to build your own fleet of the all kinds of commercial vessel, it guarantees you can trade through and transport all kinds of products and goods with your own capacity. So you guarantee that your cost in the global trade can be promised. You can control the cost in the transportation. You can control the cost of all the shipment. So it's very important to a country's economy as a whole.
Mm. Well, Professor Qu, the petitioners of the five U.S. labor unions accused China of distorting global markets in the maritime logistics and shipbuilding sectors through quote-unquote unreasonable and discriminatory acts, policies, and practices. Now, Professor, how would you respond to that?
Oh, well, in a simple word, I can tell them when the game is not making money, you quit the game. And now when the game starts to make the money and you call us stealing your game, that is how the truth is. Well, just a little bit of history, about the shipbuilding industry. You know, America used to be the largest, shipbuilding countries in the whole world. Mm. That's in the 1970s, like I just mentioned, Americans are building, probably more than 80% of the commercial ships and military ships all over the world. And also they're feeding like millions of jobs and creating huge share of the GDP, not only in America, but also in the world, economic growth. But later they find out this is not such a lucrative industry. For example, in the 1970s, everybody knows that's a peak period of time of Cold War. Mm. And USSR, go beyond America, actually, in many aspects. For example, the capacity of production of the iron and steels. And America feel, well, if heavy industry is not our game and it's not so profitable, why would we try another, strategy, for example, climb up the technology tree? So that's the time when America switched to another road, which is like a Star Wars plan, which is our Polo project. Remember that? So they switched the route and they tried to, relocate this heavy industry like shipbuilding and iron and steel to European Union, later to Japan, and then later to South Korea. And that kind of the choice in a history, of economy actually fostered European Union as integrated market, and then fostered the miracle of Japanese economy, and then, fostered the rise of South Korea economic rise.
Mm-hmm.
Because heavy industry is not very profitable. So America give up this kind of this share of industrial sector to another region who are willing to take this sweaty, dirty, cheap job.
Mm-hmm.
And also in the 1970s, I remember the global trade, slows down very quickly. So they say, okay, this is not very interesting. It's not very important for us. So why don't we just give it to our partners?
Mm-hmm.
And a similar story happened to Japan. And Japan, out of the same reason in the 1970s, because of the Asian financial crisis, so global trade slowed down again. They give it to South Korea. And also back in 2008, subprime crisis happened. Global trade slowed down again. And then this sweaty, hard job has been switched to China. And China thinks, okay, what the hell? China is the largest manufacturer of the whole world. We need our own fleet of vessels.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it's not making money by shipbuilding itself, but China can make the profit, back again from the trade. So we are willing to take this heavy, a hard industry and this job. Because Chinese people are very hardworking, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the reason why we say when the money makes money, it's not making money, you quit. And then now, currently, because of inflation, because of the world trade happened again. So this industry, not only the shipbuilding industry, but also the global trade, are making money again. So this is the time when they jump out and say, okay, you're stealing the game, and we want you to give it up and give it back to us. I don't think this is very fair.
Well, thank you for helping us revisiting the history. One more question, Professor. Has the U.S. been abusing the Section 301 of the Trade Act of 1974, in your opinion?
Yes, they're absolutely abusing it. But since it's a bilateral law, so it's hard to accuse them for abusing their own law, right?
Mm.
Well, about the 301 clause, they have three accusations. They have the general clause, they have the special clause, and also they have the super clause concerning three targeted so-called violations. Number one is about the government subsidies or government behavior. Second one is called concerning the intellectual property. The third one is about stopping the free trade, which means that you put some tricks and impede other competitors to do the free trade and free competition. Well, about these three accusations, I think in China's shipping building industry, we have none feeding these three accusations. For example, Chinese government doesn't have any subsidies on shipbuilding. Actually, Chinese ships are right now selling at a high price.
Mm.
The orders are flowing, and we have to raise the price. And secondly, about the IPR, China developed the IPR of its own shipbuilding because in history, America overprotected her own shipbuilding technology, so no one can steal or even buy their technology. And the third one is about free trade. This is a totally free market. Everybody are building ships and selling ships in a very free, condition. So I don't know whether when they can find these three accusations and, put some so-called punishment on China.
Mm. Thank you for providing so much detail and insight on this very interesting topic. And it will certainly get a lot of attention as the USTR will decide whether to respond or not in about 40 days. Thank you. We appreciate your time. That was Professor Qu Qiang, Fellow of the Belt and Road Research Center at Minzu University of China. This is World Today. We'll be right back.
Hello, I am Dr. Digby James Wren, a political analyst and international relations scholar specializing in China area studies. World Today offers unmatched in-depth perspectives on China's politics, economics, business, technology, and society. World Today's team of reporters and contributors provides valuable information from all of the world's major economies. I hope you can join me on World Today for the very best insights and news from China, on China, and help to build a better understanding of China's role in the world today.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. Malaysians have had their first look at some Chinese-made aircraft. The C919 and ARJ21 made a debut in Malaysia on Wednesday. This stop was the last leg of a five-country Southeast Asian demonstration tour for the planes, following Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, and Indonesia. Producer of the two aircrafts, Commercial Aircraft Corporation of China, or COMAC, hopes the tour will lay the foundation for future market development in Southeast Asia. For more, my colleague Xu Yawen spoke with Professor Liu Zhiqin, Senior Fellow of the Chongyang Institute for Financial Studies at Renmin University of China.
Professor Liu, what significance does the demonstration flight tour of ARJ-21 and C919 hold for both China and the Southeast Asian countries visited?
I should say this event is historically significant, not only for China, but also for Asian countries and the rest of the world, because this is the first time for Chinese-made aircraft that to be showing in this international fair. That shows that China's development has really reached a high new height, and shows that its capability to produce different aircraft, especially for those big passenger aircraft. This is a very important progress for China, as well as for the rest of the world, because many developing countries are very happy to see that China has made such a great achievement that gives them more confidence that to have the similar development in future time. So we hope that this showcase can be a good chance for further development of cooperations and collaborations of China with other countries, especially for the Southeast Asian countries, that in the aviation industry, this is a big step forward for both.
Then what advantages does Chinese-made airplanes have over its competitors in the global aviation market?
As we know that the Chinese products, as well as other products in high level or high technologies related products, that have a very special advantage from China. First is the high quality control in China. Before years, we were always talking about the cost efficiency or cost saving. But nowadays, I prefer to say that the high quality control and management is the most attractiveness for many foreign investors and foreign companies. And secondly, of course, is the cost saving and efficiency compared to the other competitors in the world. And the third, especially the China's after-sales service is among the best and reliable suppliers in the world, because China's supply chain and industrial chain both are very complete and high efficiency. This is quite important to many potential buyers because the supply chain is very stable, for instance, for the spare parts, for everything after sales. So the service is becoming more important than anything. So that's why the China's products, especially aviation products, are more reliable and they have more advantages compared to the rest of the other suppliers in the world.
Well, we know the C919 actually kicked off its commercial operations last year and signifying China's achievements as the third country in the world capable of developing large jet passenger aircraft, following the United States and Europe. So now with the aircraft making debut in Southeast Asian countries, how do these aircraft meet the various demands of markets?
As we know that the demands in the Southeast Asian countries are very diversified because many countries are well developed with the high pay or high economic booming. in these developed countries in South Asia, the country, but most of these regional countries are underdeveloped. They are belonging to developing countries. They hope that they can have some aircraft that supplied with compared with their capability of the consumption. For instance, for South Asian countries, they need small-sized passenger, but with the cost saving, with the high reliability, with high level security, that could meet their demands. And secondly, also we know that from the city to cities in this area, in this region, is a short distance, not a long distance transportation. So they need some more reliable, more practical, more easy to be manageable that aircraft to meet the demand. So in this way, that China's aircraft could be the best ideal and the rational choice for them. So they have more opportunities to make their own choice. They can buy some advanced, very high-cost aircraft from other Western countries, or suppliers like Airbus or even like some Boeing. But China is coming to provide another alternative for their own decision. They can feel that which one is much better to meet their demands or to meet their national situation economically and politically. So this is a good way for the whole world that to have more collaboration and cooperation to make a good, we call it a frankly and a transparent competition in aircraft industry.
Well, Professor Liu, we do hear analysts suggest that development of C919 and ARJ21 showcases China's transformation from made in China to create in China. How do you perceive this shift in China's aviation industry?
I personally have been involved in the aviation industry since many, many years. I think almost 40 years. Because for the years, I accompanied our space minister to visit Airbus in Europe. We visited that big passenger, the producer in Airbus. We showed this our wishes and also tried to have a cooperation in this type of passenger aircraft. Since then, that already three generations that have been changed. This is our dream that China has to create or to make our own aircraft in the world. Now the dream come to be realized. This is really a very fantastic and a wonderful time point for us. So in this way, that I should say that we may need quite a long time. In my opinion, that we need another 10 years that to make a bigger forward that from made in China to create in China, because there is something still technically should be well improved and managed. There still have some uncertainties and challenges technically, and in the world market conditions will be all changing a lot. So in this way, that I personally prefer that we remain calm, we remain realistic, that we remain that practical to make our aircraft more advanced and more reliable. Because this is a new debut sale or flight in the world. So we need the time to testify the quality of our craft, whether we should have some more improvement and more adjustment to meet the new demands of the world. Made in China is already a very great achievement for China. So created in China is something, a different level that we need more intelligent innovation in the aircraft producer and the design and the management. So in this way, we need some patience to have more concrete research and practical jobs that to be done. Made in China is the best choice for the world. And then created in China is our next dream for our new aviation industry.
Liu Zhiqin, senior fellow at the Chongyang Institute for Financial Studies, Renmin University of China. This is World Today. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Einar Tangen, a political and economic analyst and senior fellow at the independent Taihe Institute. World Today is news without the hype and business commentary that is informed and up to date, presenting the facts and asking incisive questions. So, join us if you are someone who needs to know what is happening in China as it is happening.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. Medical students in South Korea have asked their universities to justify their absences to join the protest against the government's plan to dramatically raise the medical school enrollment quota. This comes amid escalating tensions between the government and the medical circles. More than 90% of the country's 13,000 intern and resident doctors have remained off duty from general hospitals for over 3 weeks. Medical students nationwide are joining the protest, filing for leaves of absence in collective action. No such application filed in collective action have been granted. Now, for more on this, my colleague Zhao Ying joins us now in the studio. Thank you, Zhao Ying, for talking to us again.
Thanks for having me.
Medical students are now joining the protest by requesting leaves for absences. I mean, why are they doing this and how widespread is it?
Well, they see this as a way to show support for the trainee doctors who have already been on strike for weeks. So by disrupting their own education, they want to put pressure on the government to address the doctors' concerns. You know that South Korean government plan to hike the medical school enrollment quota by 2,000 seats beginning next year, up from the current 3,055. They're doing this to address a shortage of doctors in rural areas and in central but less popular medical fields. And the reason given by the government for the decision is that South Korea is far below the OECD average of 3.7 physicians per 1,000 people in the developed world, hovering at 2.1. And also the country's rapidly aging population underscores the urgent need for more doctors. But the protesters argue that the shortage of doctors is not industry-wide, but confined to particular specialties like emergency care. So they say the government has ignored the issues that have made working in these areas unappealing, such as the harsh working conditions and low wages for interns and residents. So the doctors argue that the government should increase medical fees rather than the expansion of medical admissions. And also the influx of new students may also compromise the student-teacher ratio, which could lead to diminished mentorship and guidance that could hinder the students' ability to acquire the necessary skills and knowledge to become competent physicians. And the action is very widespread. The education ministry said around 6,000 of the country's 19,000 medical students had filed for school leaves through due procedures. But if you include those whose school leave applications were not in accordance with the required procedures, such as signatures from parents and professors, the number could be nearly 14,000. And furthermore, professors from medical schools have also begun to contemplate whether to submit resignations in collective action. And on Tuesday night, medical professors from 19 universities met online, and they have decided to form a joint emergency response committee to decide whether to collectively submit resignations.
Wow. Well, Zhao Ying, Europe has also seen health workers on strikes recently. Are there any parallels or differences between, you know, the situation in South Korea and in European countries?
Well, I would say the situation in South Korea is quite different due to the structure of its healthcare system, because we know that many European countries have a primarily public healthcare system where doctors are often public servants with salaries and working conditions directly negotiated with the government. But in South Korea, the system leans heavily towards the private sector. Mm. So the doctors often work for private hospitals, which are profit-driven entities, and this influences their priorities and motivations. Public hospitals in South Korea actually represent a much smaller portion of the system compared to Europe. According to data from OECD published in 2021, only 8.8% of hospital beds in South Korea are public, compared to 100% in the UK and 61.5% in France. So while South Korean doctors share some concerns of doctors in Europe, such as working conditions and wages, their primary argument against the government's plan to increase medical school enrollment is that this is just a superficial solution, because they say simply increasing the number of doctors won't address the root causes of the shortages in specific areas, because most of the additional recruited medical students would also likely to work in high-paying popular professions like plastic surgery and dermatology, like these current medical students. And those essential but lower-paying fields like pediatrics and rural medicine will remain neglected. So although some agree that more doctors are needed, they argue that the government should focus on encouraging more doctors to move to rural regions and these essential services.
Now, what has been the government's response so far?
Well, the health ministry has just rolled out negotiations with the medical circle and reaffirmed its hardline stance. The government have also begun suspending the licenses of doctors who haven't returned to work. They see this as a way to pressure doctors back into their jobs. They've also threatened legal action against doctors who try to intimidate colleagues who try to return to work. But the crisis shows no sign of being resolved. And according to the health ministry, about 93% of the country's trainee doctors deserted their jobs, and the healthcare system is under huge pressure.
Well, tell us more about that briefly. I mean, how severe is the impact of the strike on the country's healthcare system?
Well, actually, the South Korean government has so far denied that the strikes has caused a crisis of the healthcare system, but the impact is very severe. You know, last month, a woman in her 80s died after her ambulance was denied entry to several hospitals due to the strike. Paramedics actually had called around 7 hospitals to take the woman, but were turned away due to a lack of staffing and beds, and she was eventually admitted to a public university hospital 67 minutes after she first called for help, but was pronounced dead on arrival. So with over 90% of junior doctors on strike, hospitals face a critical lack of staff, and surgeries and treatments, including those for serious illnesses, are being postponed or canceled. And patients are experiencing longer waiting times or being turned away by these overwhelmed hospitals. And also nurses are taking on additional tasks typically performed by doctors to compensate for the staffing shortages, which may raise safety concerns. And also the situation is so dire that the government have resorted to deploying military medical personnel to public hospitals. But the situation remains tense, and the resolution of the strike remains uncertain.
Thank you, Zhao Ying. Well, that's all the time we have for this edition of World Today. To listen to this again or to catch up on previous episodes, download our podcast by searching World Today. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. Thank you for staying with us. Bye for now.